Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Is Donald Trump a peacemaker? It is probably fair to say the jury is still out. He says he wants peace in Ukraine. He bombed Yemen. He certainly is approaching Israel in an unprecedented way. Trump threatens Iran while calling for peace. He's surprising us, but can he bring peace? Crosstalking Trump's foreign policy, I'm joined by my guest, Wilmer Leon in Washington. He's a political scientist, author, and radio talk show host. In Columbus, we have Misty Winston. She is an activist and host of the Misty Winston Show. And in Norton, we cross the Kyle Anzalone. He's an opinion editor at antiwar.com, as well as co-host of Conflicts of Interest. All right, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, Kyle, I want to start out with you. As I said in my introduction, a question. Is Donald Trump a peacemaker? Because over the last few days, I think he surprised the hell out of all of us, okay? Particularly his nuanced stance towards Israel. I don't know if that's going to be a longstanding approach. He did cultivate relations in the Middle East. He said this, which I think is extraordinary. The so-called nation builders wrecked far more nations than they built, and the interventionists were interfering in complex societies that they did not even understand themselves. I mean, has he been watching this program? Because that is basically the approach I've been taking for 15 years. Kyle, is it a nuanced foreign policy? Is it just confused? Is it throwing something against the wall and see what sticks? Kyle.
Yeah, so I would say that Donald Trump is not a peacemaker. And of those three, I would say confused is probably the best one to pick. He is willing to move outside of the consensus to float ideas. And this is clearly a pre-written statement that Trump, he's not speaking off the cuff. I don't think we're getting Trump's true ideas with that statement, but he is willing to put somebody in his administration and somebody at a fairly high level that they were able to write this. And the president in his first overseas trip, giving a major address, was willing to say it. And there is some significance to that. And that this kind of rhetoric is popular and it resonates is also important because it shows the political shift in the United States. And so we should, really celebrate it and tout it. However, if you look at Trump's history during his first administration and everything he's done so far, you certainly can't say Trump's a peacemaker. And as great as it is that he agreed to stop bombing Yemen, I don't see any reason why he won't just start bombing Yemen again next week, given how he's governed so far during his administration. It's great that he's been somewhat less friendly with Tel Aviv at points than Joe Biden was, but he hasn't done anything to change the U.S.-Israeli relationship. Under his watch, the Palestinians of Gaza are starving, mass famine across the strip, and he's allowing it to happen. And so, and we're no closer to end to the war in Ukraine.
Misty, I'm glad that Kyle brought that up, because when I saw that the reference that I made, the fragment from the speech he made, everybody in the audience knew that already. Nobody in the Middle East listening to that speech was surprised by it. Maybe they were just kind of surprised by the admission, but the simple facts that the United States overly meddles, threatens, and destroys countries at will. So there was no surprise there. But Misty, Kyle's right. This was for the base. The base liked to hear this.
Yes. And I'm never really impressed with rhetoric, right? I mean, politicians say lots of things all of the time, and very rarely do they ever mean what they actually say. But I do think that what Trump is very adept at, what he's very talented at, is knowing his audience. He knows who he's speaking to. He knows what they need and want to hear. And he's great at delivering that when he thinks it's necessary or required. And I think what Kyle said is very important, because I think really around the time of, the 2020 election, we really started to see foreign policy become a more central talking point and focus point for the American public than we really ever have. And now, certainly, with the situation in Gaza, foreign policy has really become something that American people are very concerned with. And that hasn't always been the case. It's always been more of a back burner issue. So I do think that seeing Trump making these statements and realizing that he kind of has to, that does show a significant shift, at least in the public consciousness of the American people.
Yeah, Wilmer, rhetoric is one thing, actions are another, because as we speak right now, there are talks going on in Istanbul. And the Trump people, as confused as they are, can't seem to come to the realization that the United States cannot mediate or broker an end to this conflict while at the same time being a co-belligerent. Trump's big words, I'll end it in a day, I'll end it by Easter, I'll end it whatever. It's being put to the test right now. And as I speak, as we do this program, I'm not optimistic he's going to get the result he wants. And maybe it's designed to fail. We'll see. Wilmer, go ahead.
Well, I'd have to first ask, what result does he want? Because
good point.
I don't know that we know the answer to that question. If I can just quickly take a step back, I think Kyle, again, absolutely right. Trump is a transactional peacemaker, which means he's not a peacemaker. And his primary concern seems to be acquisition of property. So, and what triggered this to me was the commercial that they ran when he was, I think he was in Qatar, and they showed Trump Tower coming soon. So, you know, that says to me that this is really about real estate acquisition and nothing to do with peace. Because if this had been about peace, he would have told Netanyahu very clearly, U.S. Marines are going to land. I've talked to Al-Sisi. We're bringing the aid to Gaza. The firing is going to stop tomorrow, and this is going to end. And so now, to the question that you posed, I find the whole Turkeya thing, this really seemed to be Zelensky challenging Putin. I'm going to meet you in Turkey on Monday. You don't get to call those shots. No, somebody needs to let him know he's losing this effort, if not has lost this effort. I found it interesting that Putin withheld telling Zelensky the team he was going to send. And so Zelensky sends his team. That seemed to me to be a real poker play. President Putin just wanted to find out who Turkey was going to send. I mean, who Zelensky was going to send. And the final point to me here is, it's who's controlling the Ukrainian policy? Because it really seems to have shifted from Ukraine being a vassal of the United States, this being a U.S. proxy war, to now the Europeans are controlling this through the Ukraine Defense Coordination Group.
Yeah, it's kind of like foster care. It's interesting here. exactly. It seems to me this is just more kind of a kabuki theater, because I agree with what we just heard. I mean, Ukraine has already lost, but Zelensky doesn't think he is lost, okay? He has a future somehow, somewhere, with probably bags of money. And also the American team, well, we have Witkoff and Marco Rubio and Keith Kellogg. I mean, who's in charge, okay? I mean, they're not eyeing the Russian delegation. They're not eyeing Zelensky. They're eyeing each other. This is a conflict within the administration. Go ahead, Kyle.
Right. Well, Wilmer made a few important points, and one question is who's in charge is a big one. But the other one about shifting control of the war to the Ukraine Defense Contact Group, this was something that they did in the final year of the Biden administration, explicitly calling it a Trump-proofing policy for the war in Ukraine by shifting more control over to the Europeans to even oversee the distribution of American aid into Ukraine. And so even if Trump were to end all all U.S. support for Ukraine, the Europeans would probably pit that up for some time. Now, hopefully, in that span of time, Zelensky would realize that the Europeans, and the Europeans would tell Zelensky that we can't do this forever. We're not the Americans. And so then Zelensky would go and negotiate with Putin. I think one crucial part of the negotiations will probably have to be Zelensky receiving some sort of a few hundred Marines deployed to Kiev to protect him from the Ukrainian nationalists. So when he signs the deal with Putin, he can remain president long enough to implement whatever needs to be implemented to get peace solidified.
So we need to bring in Marines to protect Zelensky against his own people. What kind of mess is this, Misty?
Yeah, I mean, I think Kyle's absolutely right, though. I think at this point, Zelensky's in way over his head. I don't think there's any question about that. And you have these neo-Nazi groups in Ukraine who will definitely come for him. And I think that it's kind of sunken cost fallacy at this point. He's in so deep that I'm not sure that he can really find his way out. And there may have been a point, and Kyle and I actually talked about this last on my show. There may have been a point where we could have offered him some sort of protection, where we could have, you know, weaseled our way out of this, but I think we're past that at this point. So I think Zelensky's really in trouble. I don't know that he's come to terms with that for himself yet, but it's definitely an unwinnable proxy war. It always was. He was always being used as that pawn, as that puppet to weaken Russia. And I think that the United States really has no business trying to be of any kind of mediator or anything. We are the cause of this whole situation. So if we really care about peace, the United States needs to just remove themselves from the equation, period. We have caused way more damage than we give ourselves credit for sure. And I don't think that we have any business attempting any kind of mediation process whatsoever.
But at the same time, the Europeans are even worse. I mean, they want to go on a war economy. I don't know why. I mean, to shore up their failings in the policies of the European Union for arms producers. I don't know. But they're going to regret this even more. Donald Trump, because of his nature, he could walk away. Doubtful, but he could. The Europeans can at this point. Go ahead, Wilmer.
Well, I think part of the answer to your question about why the Europeans are doing this is because they understand that the United States is shifting its policy towards China, and that the focus of the United States is, you know, we're like the 4-year-old child whose attention span is about 15 seconds long. And so we've grown weary of Ukraine because we went in under some false pretenses with false expectations. Russia wasn't going to fold. Contrary to what we were told, Russia was not going to fold. And now that we have come to that realization, the time now is to turn to the new shiny object, which is China. And so now I think the Europeans realize they're going to have to
start defending themselves. All right, Wilmer, folks, I have to jump in here. This is television. I have a hard break. And after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Trump's foreign policy. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing whether Donald Trump is a peacemaker. All right, let's go back to Kyle. I think, you know, and I may be wrong, and maybe I'm being overly hopeful, but if we could look at the details, and they're very disparate of what Trump has been talking about since he assumed office again, but one could make an argument that we're returning to great power politics because have you heard the rules-based order mentioned recently? I haven't, which I'm very happy about. But, you know, Trump is taking a great power approach, and that's, you know, that may, and that accounts for his interest in Greenland, Panama, Canada. And I'm not saying it would make it a better world, but we are kind of moving away from the strictures of the liberal order that was established after the Second World War. Maybe Trump is just an anomaly, but it seems like there's some elements to back up that argument. Your thoughts?
Well, I would say that even if like the rhetoric changes, the wars never do. And so, you know, under Bush, we had the neoconservative and the interventionist, and Obama was responsibility to protect. And then we had the first Trump administration, which was supposed to be America first. And then Joe Biden, which is, you know, we have to protect international world order and things like this. But throughout all of it, all the wars continued to go on. There were no actual dramatic shifts in U.S. foreign policy. Just different justification for wars. And actually what seems to happen is the, you know, the new policy means we have to go and fight this new conflict, get involved in this new arena. You know, Trump's first administration, he didn't end any wars. He ramped up several, like the war in Afghanistan, the war in Syria. And while he signed a deal with the Taliban to leave Afghanistan, Trump has said that he was never going to give up the Kabul airbase, or the big airbase, the Bagram airbase. Yes, yes. And so he said that he wasn't actually going to end that war. He actually wasn't going to leave Afghanistan. I don't see anything in Trump's track record that says we're going to get less intervention. Maybe he'll start interfering in Greenland and Panama, but whoever's the next president will just continue that down that path of war.
Well, we'll see. Misty, certainly there's a couple of areas that are changing. Again, we're all on the same page here. This is about rhetoric right now. It's less about action. But the obviously there's strained relations between the Europeans and the Americans. Primarily, it's focused on Ukraine, but also the tariff war, as it were. It seems to me that there's almost an inevitability that the United States is going to lose interest there. The real wild card right now, and maybe this is only about personalities, which, of course, Western media love to focus on, is the Trump-Netanyahu relationship, as it were. I mean, are these quirks of Trump's personalities? Personality or an indication of a policy shift?
I think it's probably more about personality. I think those are two very big ego-driven individuals, and I think it's really difficult for them to engage in any way that doesn't involve conflict. I mean, they're both very conflict-driven people as well. I think that, you know, Trump likes to be a bully. He likes to be the big man in the room. I think Netanyahu is obviously evil. So I think that it's really just about a personality clash. I don't see, again, until I actually see policy change, until I actually see, you know, where we're defunding Israel, where we're stop sending military aid, until I actually see action, I'm not impressed by these rumors of, you know, Trump ghosting Netanyahu or whatever it is. And again, Netanyahu isn't the problem. He is just merely the guy leading Israel right now. Zionism is the problem. And so even if Netanyahu has turned into some sort of a scapegoat, that doesn't solve the issue. And so, you know, these kind of personality driven conflicts and things, that doesn't interest me much. I'm not one for the drama and the rumors and all of that. So until I see actually policy shift, it's difficult for me to really buy into that stuff.
Well, we're the same thing, because you know, Trump can take his stance. I mean, he fired his national security advisor, not because he was dealing with Netanyahu. He was just dealing with him behind his back. So I'm backing up Misty on this point. It wasn't about substance, is that he took personal offense. But it's what I find very interesting, the rhetoric that we heard on this trip to the Middle East, the quote-unquote ghosting of Netanyahu, we'll use that in air quotes, but his administration, all the people around him are not of that hue whatsoever. So again, Trump is appealing to his base, not really changing policy. Again, it's too early to really say. But I mean, he's more worried about losing the base than losing Netanyahu.
If I could just quickly take a step back, you mentioned great power politics. It's hard to play great power politics when you're running out of power. And fascist authoritarians, they love to look backwards. They loved make America great again. They love to look backwards. The unipolar dynamic has totally shifted to a multipolar dynamic. And unfortunately, the American administration doesn't seem to understand that. Misty's absolutely right. This is not a conflict between the United States and Israel. This is a conflict between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu. And Misty used the word Zionism, and that's absolutely correct. And people need to understand that not all Zionists are Jews, and not all Jews are Zionists. Joe Biden is a Zionist. Kamala Harris is a Zionist. So, again, I go back to the point I made earlier. If this had really been a policy issue, Donald Trump would have said last week, I've talked to al-Sisi in Egypt, that aid that's on the border is going in because I'm sending Marines in to deliver it. And you will stop shooting immediately. The genocide stops now. Last I checked, Palestinians are still dying from malnutrition. They're dying from hunger. They're dying from cholera. They're dying from starvation. They're dying from genocide. And until he says that stops, the policy stays the same.
And now it's Trump's genocide. Let's keep it. Let's be clear, Donald Trump. You know, it's your war in Ukraine. It's your genocide. Kyle, again, going to some, back to the, some of the speeches Trump made during his Middle East trip. He had very, very sharp words for Iran, which, of course, played to the room. The room wanted to hear that. Okay, that's why he got applause. But again, looking at the people around him, you know, it's all about the bomb. Well, if it's all about the bomb, then there's a little bit of optimism there, because there's even Trump's own intelligence community says that the Iranians are not completing the nuclear cycle for a bomb. They say they don't want a bomb. So we got some material to work with here, okay? And it seemed to me that he was looking for a way out, because, you know, we've all agreed that he's not a peacemaker. There's not enough evidence of that. But does he want to be a war maker against Iran? I think there's a question mark there. Kyle.
Well, I do. I don't think Trump wants to be a war maker with Iran. And I really do hope that and don't think that the U.S. will go to war with Iran under Donald Trump. It would be a highly unpopular policy, even with his base, only 25%.
And it would be his legacy. It would be his legacy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so I'm not sure that that's a real threat. But getting a deal done seems nearly impossible, too. You know, the Iranians, the most they're willing to accept is essentially return to the Obama era deal, which Trump, during his first campaign, one of his big policy positions was that deal was weak. Obama was stupid. I'm a better deal maker. And then he got out of that deal. And so now he would essentially have to return to it. And also, his administration is completely confusing on this perspective. Can Iran have a nuclear enriched program? No, they can't. You know, it keeps going back and forth. And so I don't see him being able to get a deal done. From the Iranian perspective, I mean, it may be good that the Trump administration says all we want is Iran not to get a nuclear weapon. But everybody knows Iran isn't trying to get a nuclear weapon. That's and you have members of the administration suggesting that they're like on the brink of receiving one. We have to get a deal done within 2 weeks or go to war to prevent Iran from getting a nuke.
Yeah, Missy, again, Marjorie Taylor Greene, which I can remember when she came into Congress. I'm not a booster for her, but I do read what she puts out in social media, and that got a lot of traction. We don't want to go to a war for another country. Of course, she didn't mention the country, but it was quite obvious she was making reference to Israel. And I think most people would agree she's a barometer for the base. Trump, it's difficult to say. Trump is a barometer of Trump. That's all we can say here. But I think she does have a finger on the pulse of the base. And for someone that was derided so much in the beginning of her political career, she's got some stature right now. And Donald Trump cannot ignore her.
Well, and I think that not only is she a really accurate barometer for the base, but the base itself is very vocal. I mean, you can get on social media, and I will say the one thing, and I'm not MAGA, I'm not a Trump supporter, but the one thing I will say about his base and about his supporters is that they're not afraid to criticize him, which is kind of refreshing given that liberals refuse to criticize Democratic presidents. So they are not afraid to criticize him. They're not afraid to call him out when he's going against the grain, when he's going against what his base wants. So I think that that's really good. And I think Marjorie Taylor Greene is a very loud and vocal voice for, you know, just kind of breathing life into that those opinions. But I do think that the base itself is very vocal. They're very forceful online. They're not afraid to make their opinions known. And they will go after and critique him when they think that it's necessary. So I think that, again, as I mentioned earlier, I think that that's great. I think that we are seeing that shift. We're seeing, you know, a huge shift away from these interventionist wars. People are so war weary in this country. We are tired of, you know, spending all of our money. You know, we can't afford anything in this country for our own people, and yet we're sending billions of dollars to faraway countries to blow up, you know, poor brown kids. So I think people in this country are really, really, really done with that. And I think that that's what we're seeing.
Yeah, and nobody in the base trusts Marco Rubio. That guy's a snake in the garden all the time. That guy is awful. Wilma, we're rapidly running out of time. What does this $400 million airplane tell you, Wilmer? Because it's mercurial, it's transactional, and I think it's an absolute disgrace for the American people to watch an American president, you know, take tribute. I mean, again, great power politics. It's very far away from the rules-based order. Go ahead, Wilmer.
It's another shiny object. I think it also demonstrates that our adversaries clearly understand the weak link in the chain, which is Donald Trump. They know how to get to him. If you inflate his ego and you give him nice toys, he'll behave at the children's table.
Literally toys, that is what that is there. Misty, you're nodding your head. I mean, what is the pulse of it there? What is the reaction? Is it derision? It's funny. It's comical. It's Trump, this plane thing.
Yeah, I think for me, it's funny. I think it's just another one of those things. But I think it's also a very serious matter. We need to be very aware of the fact that it's clear that the president is being purchased right now. So, yes, as Wilmer said, this is just giving him a shiny toy, and he will behave as they wish him to do so.
Yeah, and particularly since he thinks he can keep it after his presidency.
Right.
it's really end of empire, end of ideology. It's really quite pathetic. Fake gold airplane. Okay. All right, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Washington, Columbus, and in Norton. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.